And welcome to another edition of the E-Factor, brought to you by the Clinton County Chamber of Commerce and Economic Development here in Frankfort, Indiana. So glad to be with you again, so we can get right into it. Let me tell you real quick what the E-Factor means if you haven't been able to listen to the show previously. The E-Factor represents the E-tributes of a community, not the attributes, but the E-tributes. That's right, the E-Factor in your community. The education, the employment, the entertainment, the empowerment, but probably most of all, the engagement. We talk about engagement quite a bit on this program, how you are engaged in your community, how you may be engaged in your own family, how you may be engaged in your education. Whatever the case may be, we need engaged people. And so we like bringing you guests on this program that we believe understand the power of engagement and are certainly doing their part in engaging whether either our community or they may be an employer or they may be a educator. Today, we're going to continue with the E-Factor theme and talk a little bit about energy, in particularly renewable energy. And that's why we're so excited to have the project lead of a solar farm project that is being looked at in Clinton County, Indiana, right here near Frankfort, Indiana. It is the Hardy Hills Project, and joining me today is Katya Samoltesko, and I want to make sure I say that correctly, Katya, but you could feel free to always correct me. I get corrected all the time.
That was great.
Okay, awesome.
That was great. You got that very often.
Well, thank you, Katya, and it's been a pleasure getting to know you and to getting to know the company Invenergy, the company that you represent. But let's talk a little bit about you, and folks will right off the bat recognize there's a little bit different accent. You're not from the South. Maybe you are. Maybe you're from South Ukraine. I don't know. But what is that? Where's that accent come from, Katya?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I am from Ukraine. I was born there, and I lived the first 16 years of my life in Ukraine. And then I was raised in the family of a teacher and a construction worker, so pretty simple beginnings. And then when I was 16, I won a scholarship to come to the United States and live with an American family, go to high school, get to know American culture, and I was really lucky to have that opportunity, and I was also very lucky in terms of the family that took me in, and they really parented me, challenged me, helped me grow, and encouraged me to apply to university, which I did, and then I ended up studying environmental sciences and energy, and then eventually that led me to renewable energy field and to Invenergy.
Wow. Well, you heard the opening of the program. We talk a lot about engagement here. How did that family interact and engage with you to get you interested in not only staying there, but going to school here in America and then ultimately staying in America?
Yeah, they really encouraged me to try new things, try as many experiences as I can. Meet people, try sports, take classes that were challenging and broadening my horizons. And they also asked me questions about Ukraine, about my family. They really took an interest in my world, try to understand it. And in Ukraine at that time, even though I had top grades, my family would have to basically pay a bribe for me to go to university. And so they were really struck by it, and they took me to various universities in the United States and emphasized how I could get a scholarship. And when I was at a university, they constantly encouraged me to think about what inspires me, what really makes me really excited. Because in Ukraine, a lot of the times, people are encouraged to go into very practical fields, you know, economics, maybe engineering, lawyer, things that are just very straightforward. But here, what was different about America and the family was that they really tried to figure out what my passion is and then try to find a way to make a profession out of it. And so that kind of continued as I was in college and I tried various things and then ended up taking an environmental science class. And then also in grad school, I was really interested in offshore wind energy. and they encouraged me to really emphasize that in my application, and that ended up striking chord with my graduate program. So that emphasis on passion and then really finding what drives you and what keeps you engaged with people around you and your profession, really finding your voice, that was really something that in Ukraine wasn't a given, and here in America it seems like there was more of an opportunity for me to make that passion grow into something.
Well, there's certainly a lot of passion in America. Of course, there's a lot of starving artists as well, so we have to be reminded of that. But at the same time, I think, you know, we often hear follow your heart, follow your passion, and then you'll find your purpose. So we get that, and it sounds like that was some good wisdom, some good advice from your family here in America. So let's talk a little bit about your family in the Ukraine. How did your family feel when you made the decision to stay here in America, and how's that support level been?
It was really hard for them. I'm an only child, so they didn't have anybody else once I left. And at that time, my dad lived in Portugal. He was doing construction. So my mom was basically left alone. She had her mother and her sister there and my dad's family, of course, but she didn't have any children around. So it was really hard, and I think that was a sacrifice that she took on, because she constantly thought about what was best for me, and she's a very selfless person, and she also always tried to encourage me to do new things and try to find something I really enjoy. But it was definitely hard, and the first few years for me also was really hard. I was homesick a lot, and you know, missing friends, family, food, my mom's cooking especially.
Sure.
But over time, really, you know, put down roots and understood the culture here a little bit more, and kind of what was required of me, what was expected, what we expect of each other on a regular basis. And I'm pretty close with my family. I see them only once a year now, but I love them. I know they love me, and they are always have a lot of questions and always want for me to move back or to be closer to them. So that's hard to have those kinds of conversations, but they also understand that I have a lot of opportunities here that I maybe wouldn't have gotten when I was in Ukraine.
Sure. So tell me, what are some of the biggest differences in culture between Ukraine and the U.S. That at least you've been able to see?
That's a really good question. I think the level of trust from the beginning is one. I think here in the U.S., people trust each other from the beginning a lot more. Just like your first expectation of somebody is positive, and then you almost like, if something happens and the trust is broken, that's more of a surprise, I think. In Ukraine, people are just a little bit more weary of each other, and they're not as open. So it takes a little bit more time to really get to know somebody, to really know about their family or their lives. But once you do, then that bond is for life. And the other one, more of a maybe professionally, was that the expectation in Ukraine from school to university is that when you are applying to university, when you're 17, you know what you're going to be. And we have kids who are deciding to apply. They're applying not just to a university, they apply to a department. So they apply to the Department of Economics or International Relations or Languages. And once they do that, they are on the set track. And it's very hard for them to change, because then when you're trying to find a job, they ask you where you studied and what your diploma was in. And if you have an economics degree but you want to go into a PhD program, or you want to, I don't know, teach history or something, they wouldn't let you because your professional training was in economics. And so I was really stunned here, where like my host, my family in Vermont, that's the family that took me in, my dad there studied history, then went to school for education, became a teacher, did teaching, then started to do grant writing, then started doing a housing development for seniors. So there was such a variety of options for people here, and you're not really expected to stay within the track that you studied when you were a teenager. And that's a very surprising thing, and still even now when kids do that, I have nieces, and I can encourage them to think, well, you know, you're studying computer science now, but also, you know, try to do other things so you explore other options so you're not just completely sealed from every other field because you studied computer science, for example.
Wow.
A bit of a long answer.
No, I certainly understand, and it's a big difference maker when you're making a decision on your career compared to, you know, when you're comparing the cultures. It's almost kind of decided for you to a certain degree in mm-hmm. Ukraine based upon maybe your skill level or based upon maybe even what your parents want you to do. Is that a correct assessment?
Yeah, family has definitely a huge impact on it in terms of their perception of what's a valued skill, what is needed, what is prestigious. So very rarely people have conversations about what do you really want to do. Mm. And a lot of the times people, maybe somebody would want to be a historian and wants to teach history, go to university and like be a professor, but their family decides that being a lawyer is, that's the profession, and then they are doing that for the rest of their life. So I think there's a lot of maybe a lost opportunity there, or maybe some talent that just isn't fully explored because of these constraints and expectations. And I feel like in the U.S., of course, a lot of people have other constraints, you know, the families to take care of, or older parents that require, you know, for them to do one job instead of the job that they would love to do. But in Ukraine, it's even more heightened because of the expectation of what is the desired profession, even if you do have a lot of choices. Yeah.
So what was one or two big challenges for you as you made the transition?
Well, language was one. My English was okay, but it wasn't great. And I spoke with a pretty thick British, English, and Ukrainian accent. So I mispronounced some words, or I used British words for things like, lorry instead of truck, and pupil instead of student, and some people kind of like, they took them a second sometimes to understand what I was saying. And I think just maybe having that more of a mentality of trying things, even if you don't necessarily feel very comfortable with them. And I was a very shy child, even with family, I sometimes was fairly reserved. So just being more outgoing, smiling and saying hi and introducing myself and being more engaging without waiting for people to engage me, I really have to kind of practice it and train myself to do it. And making connections and just like trusting that, you know, if somebody's inviting me to a party, they're not doing that out of an obligation, which actually sometimes is a thing in Ukraine. And then you get invited to a party and then you think, well, do they invite me because they had to, or, you know, to be polite, or they really want me to come? And believe it or not, I have these conversations with my mom now, where a lot of the time she was invited to a party, and then she's like, well, you know, I didn't really want to go, but now I was invited, but I really don't want to go, but I have to, and now I have to buy a gift, and it causes a lot of turmoil, and I feel like here, you know, it happens sometimes, but a lot of the times I learned to just accept that if I'm invited, you know, it's sincere, and if I wasn't invited, that's just fine too.
Right.
Not to really agonize over some, you know, decorum that people were trying to follow.
Right. It kind of comes back down to expectations, trust, all those things that you were mentioning earlier. So what was the switch for you, the light switch that went on regarding renewable energy, and that is the field that you wanted to get in? What was driving that passion?
Well, I think it was a couple of energy and environment classes where we were looking at emissions, just pollution from sources like coal and oil, but also in terms of the national security question. So my degree in college was government, so like political science and environmental studies. So I took a lot of classes in international relations and security. And it really highlighted how energy drives relationships between countries and how a lot of conflicts in the world are about natural resources, including oil, not coal so much, but oil. And so I started thinking that, you know, if we didn't have to go to war over resources, whatever that resource is, it would have a positive impact on the level of human suffering in the world. So if we didn't have wars, we wouldn't have orphans, we wouldn't have refugees, we wouldn't have women who lost husbands and loved ones, we wouldn't have dead animals, there would just be less destruction. And one of the ways we can do that is if we explore homegrown power sources. And wind and solar, that's one of the things. You know, hydro, I looked at that when I was in college, but wind and solar were becoming more mainstream, and when I was still studying, they weren't as cost-effective, so it was really like a policy choice. Like, if you calculate that, you know, we spent X amount of money on foreign wars over the last, you know, 100 years, or maybe the last 50 years, and if you include that in your decision-making, not to mention human lives, maybe it's really a policy choice to invest into renewables at home, because then you are more secure and you are not dependent on countries that might not like you because of something else that you did. So it's that independence and security that was really driving decision. And then, just as I mentioned before, you know, I'm coming from a country that had communism, had a lot of death. World War II was terrible for Ukraine, but during communist regimes, a lot of people suffered because of their political beliefs. So I'm sensitive to the desire to do something that reduces human suffering and reduces conflict and death and, you know, just all this pain. So it felt like something I could really contribute to, where I could be in the field where we invest into our communities, we give our people jobs, and we also are protecting our international interests when we're not depending on others for vital natural resources.
So it's more certainly a passion. We've used that word a lot today, but it's more of a passion, and you're fulfilling a purpose in your life than just a job, that you're just clocking into getting a paycheck. You really look at this as an opportunity to have a platform to speak about energy independence and being able to have homegrown energy.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's all connected in my mind. And the other kind of connection with Ukraine there, just my experience growing up, was that Ukraine is and was very much related on Russia, dependent on Russia for natural gas. And because Ukraine was dependent on Russia for natural gas, Russia was able to do a lot more politically to Ukraine because of that dependence. So again, if Ukraine was self-sufficient, let's say it had its own natural gas resources, which it does, but not enough, and then if it had its own renewable energy sources to make up for the lack of other resources, and it was more energy independent, it was free to do more and not look to see what Russia would think about action 1, 2, and 3. And then just overall investment in communities and like that growth. These projects, renewable energy projects, it's this massive capital investment that stays in the community. Like, it doesn't go anywhere, and it's clean. It doesn't pollute the air. It doesn't pollute the water. And so I just really like how it almost like, for me, it comes together. All of these different things come together with renewable energy.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about the company that you work for and that you represent in Invenergy and what they do, mm-hmm. both on the worldwide or the global stage and here in America.
Yeah, Invenergy is very much a company that is fairly well established at this point. We've been around since 2001, and our core group of leaders have been together for probably 30 or 40 years. They've started another company together. They really know each other very well. They know how they work, and they really want to invest in communities and do so with innovative solutions. So that's, that means doing things better than others, and whether that comes with wind, solar, natural gas, energy storage, liquefied natural gas. We have a new project in El Salvador. And our focus has grown from the United States and Canada to now several countries, and that includes Japan, Mexico, El Salvador, as I mentioned. And we are just really trying to invest in multiple, in as many communities as we can, and on the local scale in the U.S. and then globally, to come up with sustainable energy solutions. And in the United States, our portfolio is definitely growing towards solar. Mostly it's wind right now, but we are seeing a lot of demand for solar as the costs have dropped. And Invenergy is just a company that is always trying to do things better. So whenever we approach a project, we try to come up with the best possible design that is cost-effective, because our assumption is that we will own the project and we will operate the project for its life. That really affects how we design it. We're not interested in just doing quick business and then leaving. Most of our projects that we've developed, we still own, whether that's fully owned or still own as a stake in them.
So let's talk a little bit about the projects. This would be your second project in Indiana as far as solar?
It's our, you could probably say, second or third most advanced. We have another couple of projects that are maybe a little bit ahead of it. So we haven't really built the project in Indiana, but in terms of level of development, the one in Clinton County is pretty far up there.
Okay, so when you're talking about this project in Clinton County, which is Hardy Hills, the solar, the Hardy Hills project, let's kind of break it down a little bit for folks that may have not necessarily gone to the public meeting or have not heard a whole lot about this. We're talking somewhere just a little less than 1,800 acres, but how does that break down, Katya, as far as land mass and where panels are? And I know that you have an overlay, and that was recently approved by the planning or the zoning board. But let's break down the project a little bit so folks can understand it better.
So the project size is 195 megawatts. That's just the way in energy industry we determine project sizes. And to give folks an idea, it would generate enough power to provide electricity to about 40,000 homes.
Wow.
So that's a very large project. And in terms of acres, we've applied for a solar overlay district that is about 1,700 acres. But within that area, there are a lot of woods and wetlands and other areas that we can't use. So actually within that area, the panels will be, when they're fenced in, it will be on about 1,300 acres. And that's not one big block. That's like multiple sections with plenty of corridors for wildlife like deer to pass through. But even within the 1,300 acres, the interesting thing is that because panel rows have to be pretty far apart so they don't shade each other throughout the day, only about 360 acres, if you just count the surface area of the panel, actually are panels. Everything else will be grass. And it's not going to be like a golf course grass where nothing really lives. It's going to be prairie grasses. And we take great pride in that because we believe that these projects essentially become huge biodiversity hotspot, and we are creating a meadow, a 1,300-acre meadow, or maybe a little bit more once you account for the buffer areas. And that will be vegetated, and it will be a great home for bees, butterflies, birds, mice, squirrels, whatever else, and we'll have some pollinator species in there as well. So it's going to be a real great place for various animals and insects.
Well, some people might say, though, wait a minute, I hear that solar panels burn up birds and they fry animals. Tell me the difference between, because those are totally different kind of projects or totally different type of panels, correct?
Yes. So that would be concentrated solar, and that's solar panels that look like mirrors. And it's not really being utilized very much anymore. There are a couple of projects in California in the desert with this technology. But what we are proposing are the typical silicon panels that are those dark blue like panels with squares, and they're really common. They've been around for 40, 50 years, and people have been using them, putting them near schools and on top of houses, and they're incredibly durable and safe, and they do not have any impact on birds. They don't get really hot enough. It's almost like the increase in temperature would be like, having a truck sit in the driveway on a sunny day. Sure, it will be hot, but it's not going to burn an insect if it touches it, or it's not going to, fry a bird that passes over it. So it's not going to have any negative impacts on the wildlife, and if anything, with such a huge prairie grass cover, it will actually be good for birds, because especially for bald eagles or hawks, there'll be so many mice and chipmunks and other food essentially that will live there that they're more likely to actually enjoy being around the solar project. And we have projects in Illinois, one project in Illinois where there are hawks regularly in the area, and we haven't seen any impacts that I'm aware of.
I know one of the other questions that folks have about projects like this, anytime you change the landscape, Katia, you might change the value of property around a project. Can you speak to that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that concern is certainly something we hear a lot, and we've done many studies on this issue, and there's just no evidence from the actual real world transactions. So there's a lot of fear, and when something is new, people are not really sure how to react, and then they are scared about impacts on their homes. But there aren't any, primarily because things that affect property values usually generate noise, dust, traffic, water, and solar projects don't do any of those things. Once they're built, there's not going to be any noise. They're going to be dark at night. You won't even know they're there. They're not generating glare. There's projects at airports, so that's just really not a concern. There's no odor, there's no unpleasantness about it. Also because with the prairie grasses, it does look nice. We've committed to using a deer fence, so it's not going to look like an industrial site. And also with the Clinton County requirements, we will be putting screening from residences, so we will basically have a some sort of vegetation, most likely evergreens, but that's something we still have to propose to the county, and we've been talking to several landowners already in terms of their ideas what would work for them. So the projects will not have an impact from the visual point of view on property values, and if anything, from our research, we've seen that with the influx in property taxes that these projects pay, with the jobs that they bring, it's actually a signal to the community that there is investment. There's a signal to schools that the property tax base is propped up. There's more money coming in terms of services that the county can provide for roads, ambulances, fire districts. So if anything, it's a good sign for the community to have this kind of investment come in. And for this particular project, the investment would be over $200 million.
Well, and it's a pretty incredible number. Well, I'll tell you, Katya, you've just finished the fastest 30 minutes in E-Factor history. You've been so engaging. We thank you very much for your time today, and we appreciate the project. And I hope folks will get on board and certainly take a look at this and dive a little deeper as questions are being asked, and hopefully questions will be answered, and we can go from there and see a project possibly come to Clinton County. So thank you very much today for joining us.
Thank you, Sean.
All right, Katya Simultesco, she is from the company Invenergy, and has been joining us today working on the Hardy Hills project in Clinton County. And hopefully we'll see how that works out. And certainly we believe that it will be a great thing for Clinton County. I actually live right there in the Little Lake area and know that from my standpoint, we look forward to the opportunity of seeing things like this in progressing in our community so that we can be more viable from an economic development standpoint. Well, that does wrap it up for another edition of the E-Factor. Until next time, listen, go out and make it a great day. You be the answered prayer. Maybe you could be the hope. Maybe you can be the engaging factor in someone else's life. Maybe you can empower somebody else's life, just like someone empowered Katya's life to stay here in America and get engaged with the company that she works for. Until next time, have a great weekend. We'll talk to you soon.